Something really weird and fascinating is happening right now as you watch and listen to this video. Sounds are streaming into your ears, or maybe if you're watching this while it's muted and you're looking at the closed captions, you're seeing or hearing symbols, some kind of stimuli that's coming into your brain and somehow triggering very specific thoughts and ideas and connections and memories in your brain. And that is what we broadly refer to as language, right? And right now I'm using language to convey those thoughts into your mind, directly into your brain. And that seems really normal, right? But just think about how strange it is that you're sitting here spending maybe an hour, the whole hour, watch the whole episode, listening to us make sounds and gestures like I'm doing with my hands right now to convey information to you. We just rarely do we ever stop and think about how odd that is and how does that even work in the brain. So today we're going to be talking about the neuroscience of language, and it is just a fascinating field. So I'm excited to jump into it. Let's get to it. Welcome to The Social Brain. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Taylor. And this is a show where we dive into how the brain works. If you've ever wondered what's going on inside your mind, even the things that you're not even aware of, then this is the place where we can unpack that and really explore it. So, you know, in my history and like researching neuroscience and all of these things, I've actually been somewhat averse to like even looking at the research of language. And I think a lot of that personally came from my disdain for English class. Like, I hated English so much, just like the grammar and the syntax and like learning all of these like fancy words. I know how to talk, right? But I think as I've gotten further in my career and really like come to appreciate just how incredible the brain is, language is just like mind-blowing how effortlessly it works. Right. That right now, like how many words have come out of my mouth right now and have created this complex waveform that, like, if you have headphones in, it's just the headphone creating like little like waves in the air in your ear that are then turned into these neural impulses. There's no white spaces between any of those sounds like there are when you're like reading something on paper. Yet somehow your brain is just like effortlessly like separating these things into word, putting them into context, into meaning, putting like this sentence together with the paragraph and turning it into a narrative, connecting it to all of the memories that you've maybe ever had about psychology, about language, about the brain, about anything, right? Like, and that's all happening in milliseconds, right? Like, this is one of the coolest things that the brain does. And like, what I think we really want to try to accomplish today is to really kind of reveal a lot of that, just like the awe in trying to understand the complexity of this without getting too bogged down in like teaching you about phonemes and like all of these things that can kind of drown out some of the amazingness. We're still going to touch on some of those concepts and look at how those things line up with different brain activation and things like that. But I think our overarching goal is to really just allow you to really have some awe and some wonder in the thing that you take for granted and being able to communicate really complex ideas with one another.
Yeah, it's like you're saying, it's worth noting that, like, you know, the neuroscience of language is inherently kind of a multidisciplinary field, like the study of language in general, because you've got linguistics, you've got, you know, like you're mentioning just English, you've got literature, you've got then the study of the brain and how we actually process and produce language and all these things. And it's a huge field. So we're not, like Taylor said, we're not really going to be touching so much on the kind of like linguistic side of it per se, but more on like, what is the brain doing? What are kind of these really fascinating things? Like, how does this actually happen in the brain? So one thing we're thinking about, like that we've kind of touched on in the last episode on music, is just to think about how could this very seemingly unique to humans function have evolved? Like, why do we seem to have it and no other species have it, at least not to the like advanced degree that we have? You know, maybe whales have whale songs and birds have bird songs and monkeys have, you know, various ways of signaling different kinds of predators coming in. But none of them, you know, have podcasts and written correspondences and all this kind of stuff. So I think we'll jump right into the evolution.
And it's something that you just pointed out, Andrew, that's really interesting to think about, is that even our closest relatives ancestrally, right? These great apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, they can learn to use language, right? They don't have the right kind of vocal tract to be able to actually voice a lot of these words, but they can learn hand gestures and they can map those hand gestures to meaning, right? But a lot of what happens there is very kind of rigorous in terms of really kind of training that over time and like through lots of repetition and all of these things. Whereas, I mean, I've watched with my own son how effortlessly we as children can just pick up and just start using language, start imitating the things that we're hearing around us, but not just imitating, but also like learning the actual structure of the syntax and being able to form our own kind of unique creative sentences that we've maybe never even heard before at like the age of 3, right? And so there is something evolutionarily that's setting us apart as humans that gives us the ability to just absorb all of this and to be able to then kind of produce it back out.
Yeah. And like a lot of this stuff, it probably, you know, I think the evidence on this isn't super solid, but it probably evolved gradually, right? Like there's probably proto language in early hominids. And then as we get closer and closer to Homo sapiens, we obviously have language, spoken language, and maybe our Neanderthal cousins and the Denisovans, maybe they also had some form of of spoken language, which is hard to definitively prove, but they do seem to share some of the genes that are important for language production or the pathways in the brain that support language. I think what you were just mentioning there, that your son and, you know, all kind of normally developing children have this predisposition to take in language. And this is kind of goes to the linguist Noam Chomsky, who had this idea called the poverty of the input or poverty of the stimulus argument, where, you know, we're speaking, when you speak to each other, we're not speaking in perfectly grammatical sentences all the time. And we're kind of going back, and you can hear it in my speech right now. I'm just talking and trying to convey an idea with, you know, incomplete sentences and going back over them and all of that. And so it's like, how do children effortlessly extract the structure and that syntax of language? It's a question that seems to lead to the conclusion that they have some innate ability to not just pick up on words and phrases, but on the actual underlying structure of the language.
And that's, I think it's really important to put that into some like historical context, right? So Chomsky came on the heels of the behaviorist movement in psychology. And the behaviorist movement was all about like, we come into the world as blank slates. That's like, we know nothing. There's nothing that's like coming to the table. And we then have to learn through reinforcement, through all of these things, everything that we then do, right? And so the idea with language from the behaviorist standpoint was that we are imitating through reinforcement, right? That I say something to my child repeating it back, gets some kind of positive emotion from me or gets some kind of support, and then just starts repeating those words, right? Chomsky's argument on the other side was like, these children are not just repeating what they've heard. They are creating like brand new creative sentences. And so it's not that they're just kind of repeating all of these things. They're actually learning the structure, like Andrew was just saying. And I mean, I see this too, where there's actually like an overuse of the structure, which like my son will say that like someone took his toy, right? He's learned the ED of like someone did something in the past tense, but then he adds the ED on a bunch of words that shouldn't have ED, right? And so it's this idea that he's found these components of words that are able to be kind of connected in these really intricate ways. And like, this is not something that we have to rigorously teach them, right? Through just daily interaction, through like, hey, buddy, come on, let's get going. Let's, do you want to sit down and eat our food? Like that whole interaction is teaching him through so much kind of data that's coming in that there is a structure to this. And that's where I think Andrew was really getting at, which is the idea that like effortlessly, there's parts of the brain that are just glomming on to that structure. It's not that he's like looking there and like, like taking notes. Yeah. It's something that his brain is just doing.
Yeah. And it's worth noting also like that babies, when they come out, you can attest to this, Taylor, that they are, it's almost like, especially in before they really develop language, they're like trying to talk almost that babbling and you know, kind of there's like something there that is trying to come online too. It may be worth mentioning too that this poverty of the stimulus argument, or this language instinct as Steven Pinker calls it, there is some controversy in the fields of whether that is like the final, you know, and that's the final answer to all this. I think there's a ton of evidence and a ton of just, you know, observations from parents like yourself, Taylor, to at least corroborate the basic idea that we have some inclination to finding the underlying structure, grammar of language. And that's what Chomsky called the universal grammar.
And I think something that's really interesting kind of on this note is that it kind of shocked me as a parent how much my child was able to understand before he could speak, right? That like there, I mean, even like around like two, giving him like complex multi-sentence, like go get that and then bring it over into the kitchen, right? Like something that he had to do one step and then do another step and was able to like understand and go through that whole thing without being able to produce any speech himself. And so there's something about mapping sound to meaning, mapping like gesture to meaning, like something that Andrew was hinting at with the evolution of language, probably started with gesture. Like if you're watching this on YouTube, I've been using my hands this whole time, right? And it's not something that I'm trying to do. It's just like how I talk, right? And you think about like apes do this all the time with like pointing and like showing like this means I want you to go over there, right? That there is this kind of mapping of visual. And then what I think is really interesting with humans is that we then started to use the auditory domain as well of mapping kind of these sounds. It could have been onomatopoeia type words like drip actually sounds like dripping water, right? And then morphing into words that like, okay, if I can now map these like sound words onto meaning, can I also then map these just like nonsense? Because like cat, right, doesn't refer to that sound, does not sound like a cat, that sound doesn't look like a cat, but somehow we've now connected those two things in our brain, and we're able to like bring that whole image to mind just with that sound.
Yeah, that is super interesting. And another way we're getting a lot into this, but just came to mind that I think there are studies on I'd have to look at this again, but children who are deaf, right, who can't hear, and when they're put and who have never learned sign language, but when they're put in like a community of other deaf children who also, and this may be adults, I may be getting these mixed up, but the point is that the people who have never learned spoken language before start to develop a sign language, you know, not as maybe sophisticated as like American Sign Language or these ones that have been around for a long time, but it's just kind of going along with this idea that there does seem to be something interesting about the human brain, something special about it that predisposes us to language. And, you know, I think it's important to also think about like the difference between language and communication, which we've touched on, that there are species that use verbal communication, like birds, bird songs, mm-hmm. very like, you know, sophisticated patterns of sound. And I was listening this morning to somebody talking about how hummingbirds will, in addition to while they're singing, they will clap their wings together to kind of emphasize a syllable in their song, so to speak. But again, like, I think we just have to come back to like the observed reality that humans are the only ones that have the degree of symbolic communication, the sort of advanced symbolic communication that we have. And this points to something that I think is another important distinction is writing, right? So we've been talking basically this whole time about spoken language, speech and speech perception, but there's also something very specific to humans, which is writing, which is using visual symbols to convey something that was originally only auditory.
And that, I mean, is what, 5,000 years old? Like, super new. And now you're integrating an entire new system, right? You have this whole, like, because we've been talking for a lot longer than we've been writing, right? So we have this whole system of like mapping sound to meaning, but now we have this other node that we have to add in as well of like, okay, now I have this visual input that I have to map to maybe the sound input, then map to the meaning input. Like there's this whole really interesting kind of intricate way that all of these things kind of come together. And I think that something that's really interesting to just kind of mull over is that I think a lot of our kind of evolution of language probably happened because of our sociality, because of the fact that we started to have really complex societies that required a lot more coordination with like, hey, I'm going to do this and you go do that. Like, I need to figure out how to tell you that I'm going to do this and you go do that, right? And how to really kind of separate the labor to create these vast communities that we've lived in for thousands of years.
Yeah, and it's that communication across time too. So you can mm-hmm. read something that someone wrote 1,000 years ago and get the message basically, 1,000 years later. And that's something really specific to writing. And yeah, you mentioned it's only about 5,000 years old, which really indicates it's, you know, probably there are biological correlates, maybe even genetic correlates of this, but that writing is really a learned thing. Like children don't just naturally start writing, you know, this has to undergo some serious training. And, but there are brain regions that seem to be specific for reading, which we'll get into later. So do you want to continue on evolution or should we start getting into
it? Let's hop in. Perception? Let's look at how language works. So, one of the things that we need to think about, and this is something that's really, I think, important to keep in context through all of this, is that language is kind of tough to study from a brain perspective, right? When I stick someone in an MRI scanner with the kind of work that I do, I'm looking at what's called a hemodynamic response. And so that's basically saying that this brain region was active, and because it was active, it needs to be replenished with some kind of nutrients or whatever. And I'm looking at that blood coming like 4 to 6 seconds after the activity, right? But when we're trying to understand language, we're trying to understand language in a very quick repetition, like a sequence of words, right? I say this word and I say that word. I can sometimes say 2 or 3 words in a second, right? How do I then map the activity or whatever is going on in terms of me putting these sounds together, in terms of me putting words and meanings and all of that? How do I map that onto brain activity? And so a lot of the work that's actually been done has been done with other modalities like EEG. There's another one called MEG, which kind of looks like a big toilet bowl on top of your head. But they're a lot better for timing effects. And so they can tell us a lot about like, wow, the brain just cared about something a lot at like 170 milliseconds, but they're not very good at localizing that function, at saying like, oh, this is like this specific spot. And so keep in mind that like there's still a lot to figure out around language and how we kind of put these pieces together. And there's also a lot of really diverse kind of subfields within this kind of overarching thing that we call language. There's some people that are really interested in how we just understand the tiny little sounds that make words come together, right? And there's other ones that are interested in how we take those and put them into a semantically well, like structured sentence. And there's other ones that look at how we then take those sentences and understand them in a narrative, right? And so we're trying to kind of bridge a lot of these things and to give kind of an overarching picture of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. And I think something to keep in mind is there's really great paper that Taylor and I were discussing before this show by Evelina Fedorenko, Ivanova, and I'm not going to get the last, Tamar Regev. Anyway, they're all from MIT and Harvard and Georgia Tech. And they're talking about that there's a lot of this evidence where you've got basically a language specific network in the brain. And we'll get more into this. We'll talk more about some of these regions, but you've got this language network that is seems to be centered on areas, especially on the left side of the brain in the frontal cortex, kind of near the bottom, but on the outside, and in the temporal lobe on the lateral areas there. So it's, you can kind of think of it as like the left side of the brain. There's these specific areas that seem to be really involved in processing language as such, not in just processing sounds or meaning, but in that sort of in-between space where we're the kind of things we're talking about when we say syntax and grammar and words. This network seems to be kind of the go-between for the motor regions that are producing kind of the speech, like I'm talking right now. Those mouth movements, those are kind of a different set of brain regions that are controlling that. And the, you know, the meaning making, where you're taking in the sounds that I'm making and converting them into ideas and thoughts in your head, that may be a separate set of networks. So I think that's kind of a good heuristic to think about, that there's this, seems to be this language specific network.
So you have sounds that come in that then have to pass to this network, and those sounds need to be kind of split up, put together into words. Where does this word stop? Where does this next word start? How do these words fit together? Is there noun-verb agreement? Does this sentence make sense, right? There's this whole kind of trajectory of accessing the mental lexicon, right? Like where is this word in association with other words, and how does that fit in this sentence, right? And a lot of this, like he was mentioning, is on the left side, left side, I touched my right side, along what's called the Sylvian fissure. And so it's kind of the top of the temporal lobe on the side of the brain. And this is important because that's where the primary auditory cortex is. So the part of the brain that's really responsible for parsing out the frequencies of sounds and saying like, okay, this is a high tone, this is a low tone, right? There's a building process that then happens, right? That first region is just processing sounds really quickly. Like this is a high frequency sound, this is a low frequency sound. There's kind of this complex waveform coming in, but then it's passing all of that to these next regions that are then taking those high and low frequencies and spatial patterns and temporal patterns, and then putting them together into different things. And again, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that this is left lateralized, like Andrew was saying. So this usually, like, we see languages everywhere, right? Don't come out of this under the assumption that like the left half of the brain is where all the language is. But I think a really interesting theory that I've kind of come across, this happened in our episode with music and everything, is that I think that the right half of the brain and the left were responsible early on for understanding kind of the inflection of the sound, right? That there was like, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm like, right, and all of these things. But then as language started to adapt, the right half kept doing that, but then the left half started to specialize more in this stuff to kind of separate the labor of the two, right? And so you still do see language stuff in terms of prosody, in terms of like understanding the inflection and the tone of what's being said on the right. But a lot of the kind of meaning and understanding and kind of language specific stuff is on the left.
Yeah, seems that's to be really left. Right. That's a good way of saying that. So we've kind of talked a little bit about this, but how kind of different levels of linguistic units, right? Where you were just talking about syllables, and then you get syllables put into words put into phrases, are processed at different neural frequencies. So this kind of brings us back to talking about the EEG and MEG traces. And basically what Taylor was saying before is, when you're looking at these, what you're seeing is like almost like whole brain activity in a way, where it's, you're just seeing, is there more activity when somebody hears like a word versus a phrase versus, or sorry, a syllable versus a phrase versus a sentence. And you can see the difference in those specific linguistic units in terms of the amplitude of response on an EEG. So it's evidence that our brain is processing kind of discrete linguistic units in different, basically at different time intervals.
And this like blew my mind when I actually saw some of the results that Andrew is talking about. It's really, really cool. And so the brain is naturally just kind of in a rhythm most of the time. It's the neurons are kind of syncing together, and you see this on an EEG. You see these just like really kind of consistent patterns of on, off, on, off, on, off. And they almost talk about it like that's like the breathing rate of the brain, that it's just kind of like, and what they found is that across cultures, no matter what language you're speaking, there seems to be a consistent distance between syllables, that like all of them have this like, and when I say syllable, it's like the, like, I, I went, I is a syllable, went is a syllable, right? Garage has two, right? Those are usually split about 4 hertz from each other. And what we find is that there's like this peak at 4 hertz where we're like processing syllables every 4 hertz that are kind of in rhythm with what the brain is already doing. But then we see that there's this other peak at like 2 hertz that seems to be more linked to, okay, we had these syllables, but these syllables are together in a phrase. And then we have another peak at 1 hertz, which is, okay, these phrases all together make a sentence. And so you see this kind of like timing effect where you have this like this low level, like I'm picking up syllables as you talk. And then I have this like one step above that, this other kind of rhythm that's happening that's putting those syllables into phrases. And then another step above that where we're seeing this kind of sentence structure. And what's really cool about EEG and kind of the MEG data too is that we see timing effects with that. That we talked a lot on this podcast about most of our perceptions are a building process. It's not just like this part of the brain is listening and putting everything together. It's that this part of the brain is responsible for the first step and then it's passing it. And then this next one has a peak that's putting those things together, right? That those different peaks are probably actually occurring in different regions, right? As the signal kind of moves through the cortex.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us to something you were sort of mentioning earlier, where you have these, we kind of talked about how there's a bit of lateralization to these language networks, where it seems like the left hemisphere is more dominant for language processing and speech production. But there's nuances to that, as Taylor was indicating. Like, we've talked a lot about when we talk about perception, whether we're talking about vision, or we even talked about this in the music episode, that there appears to be this kind of generalized architecture to perceptual capacities in the brain, where you have a ventral stream of information, so it's traveling on areas that are more closer to sort of the bottom of the brain, and then a dorsal stream, which is like closer to the top. And it seems like language may have a similar architecture there as well. And so that lower stream, that ventral stream, seems to be present on kind of both sides of the brain. And this is what Taylor was talking about, where it's like the sort of the auditory, the kind of low level auditory information of like understanding sounds and phonemes. But then what is more left lateralized is this dorsal stream that kind of breaking these into syllables and understanding and piecing together those syllables into coherent meaning. But again, like this, there is some like messiness in this picture, and it's not like one side of the brain does, you know, speech and one does comprehension. It's a little bit more spread out than that.
And it's, I think something that's really interesting here is that this dorsal ventral kind of organization of the brain seems to be something that's an inherent structure of a lot of our perceptual systems. And so when we think about evolution in general, evolution doesn't usually make new things. Evolution tinkers with pre-existing structures and kind of recycles things that were already being used for something else for a new purpose because you as an organism have a new need, right? And so there's a lot of like from Hickok, he's one of the big authors on this kind of dorsal ventral idea. His idea is like, okay, well, that makes sense that the language system is just kind of being put on top of what already existed there. That there's a pathway when we're listening to someone that's all about trying to understand what that person is saying, right? You're sitting here, you're trying to listen to the meaning, you're trying to incorporate that with your beliefs, your ideas about the world, right? But then there's another set. So the dorsal region is usually, it was first described as like the where pathway, right? You have the what, the meaning, like that's the ventral one. And then the other one was usually used to be called the where pathway, but a lot of people are now switching to calling it like the how pathway, because it's really more about taking what you're hearing and then trying to understand what you're going to do with that information, right? And like where makes sense because with visual, right? So vision, you have this dorsal and ventral stream where the ventral stream is trying to identify the identity of objects. This is a microphone. This is a camera, right? But the dorsal stream is trying to identify them in relation to you, right? Where is that thing? Because if I want to grab my water bottle, I need to know where it is in relationship to me, right? Same with language, right? As I'm hearing something, it's like, what am I doing with this language? What am I planning on? Am I planning on speaking when it's my turn, right? Is that the next step that I need to turn all of this into a motor output next, right? And so we're starting to see this kind of division of labor of like, I need one kind of section that's maybe trying to understand what you're saying, and then another section that's preparing for all of the motor actions that I'm going to do with that language.
Yeah, that's really good. I think you corrected and clarified some of what I said before. Because yeah, you're right. The dorsal stream is more about like articulation and speech itself, and that sort of like, what am I going to do with this information, rather than just what is it, which is more kind of the ventral stream. And so, and that seems to be reflected in some of the kind of the neurological literature, where when people get left hemisphere damage, they're more likely to have a speech deficit. So I have permission to talk about this, because I just talked to a friend this past weekend, and he gave me permission to talk about it on this podcast. And he experienced, because of a cycling accident, got left frontal damage to his brain, obviously. And he described what it was like to experience aphasia. And he's since recovered, or largely recovered. He's still dealing with some mental fatigue and some other stuff. But he talked about how it was strange, because, and it wasn't like this completely obliterated his language centers, right? It was just some damage to it that caused some issues for him, like having difficulty understanding speech, especially if it was using really complicated words. And he happens to be a scientist, so he deals with complicated words a lot. And so he's basically had been relearning to speak and to use words to, like, it was like he could understand the concepts that were being said and that were in his mind, but he had so much trouble putting them into words or even understanding the sort of verbal communication of those ideas. Like, he said that it was like the concepts were there, but the language itself was perplexing. And so I thought that was, it's a good way to see like the sorts of things that can happen with damage to these areas, and just what you would predict from a left frontal damage patient.
And, you know, we're doing an episode on language. I think it's really important to mention Brokaw and Wernicke. That they really kind of set up the stage for what's kind of considered the classic model of language. So before we knew anything about the brain, through neuroimaging, through EEG, any of this stuff, most of what we knew about the brain was from lesion studies, which was people that had damage to their brain that lost some type of behavioral capability. And we didn't even know, like, we would just, the person that was studying them had some kind of interest and would take a bunch of notes and try to understand like the intricacies of this behavioral anomaly that was happening. But then it wasn't until that person died that we were able to even map that onto brain function, because then we would have to do a postmortem kind of dissection and see like, oh, this is where the damage was, right? And some of these early ones were Paul Broca and Carl Wernicke. That they discovered two very different types of language deficits. Andrew was referring to the term aphasia. That's kind of a loss of language in some way. And there's different types of aphasia. And so Wernicke, which is Wernicke's area, is kind of left kind of back here, the junction of like the temporal lobe with some of the other ones, that when people had damage to that area, it seemed like they were unable to understand, to comprehend speech anymore. But then Broca's area, which is kind of up in the front, this is the kind of inferior frontal gyrus up here, when they have damage to that area, they seem unable to talk. And that's kind of what Andrew was just hinting at with his friend, is that you seem to have comprehension completely intact. So when that person was hearing things, they could understand exactly what was being told to them. But then transforming that back into a motor output was really difficult. And you can look up like videos of people with Broca's aphasia that like they know what they want to say, and you can see the frustration on their face. They just can't get it out. And this set up this like early model. There's a lot of jokes when you look at like conference talks from language neuroscientists, where they're like, this is a map of the visual system, and it's this super complicated tree of like all of these different nodes connected to one another. And this is the auditory system, and it's like not as complex as vision, but it's still like all over the place. And this is language, and it was basically just like Broca and Wernicke's area talking to each other. And there's a white miter path that goes between them. So there's a connection between Broca and Wernicke's area called the Arcit Fasciculus that they thought that like, okay, we have understanding and we have production. And all language is kind of a connection between these two. But throughout time, we now understand, like we've actually looked at like Paul Broca's famous tan patient, that he had a lot more damage. Like all of it Broca could see was what was on the outside. But then we image the brain because it's still housed somewhere, that there was a ton of damage throughout the brain, different connections and all of these kind of things. And so that early kind of simple model of like, this is understanding and this is speech is not the way that it is. There's some stuff to that, but there's actually a lot of evidence too that like Broca's area for speech is actually really heavily involved in understanding syntax as well, which is a comprehension thing. So
which goes along well with what my friend experienced too, because it is hard to tell, you know, even from MRI scans nowadays exactly where damage has occurred in the brain and everything. But yeah, he had difficulty with both production and understanding of language. But I think what's interesting about all this is that it leaves semantic knowledge, that is like your knowledge of facts and that sort of thing, intact, right? As well as your reasoning ability, basically. So you've got, like, it really does seem like language has this specific, these specific areas that are dedicated to processing and producing language rather than thought or reasoning or perception in general.
And that's, I think, something that I've seen. So Alexander Huth, he's kind of a newer rising star in the field. He's actually got some stuff where he can kind of decode what you're thinking or hearing just by looking at your brain activity. But he did some really interesting work with language that showed that language is the actual representation of words is widespread. And it's actually what they would call embodied, right? So if I'm thinking about the word eat, that representation is actually showing up in the gustatory cortex, where I process and food and taste and all of these things, right? Whereas like motor words, like movement words, are kind of activating motor regions and these kind of things. And so there's a lot of our actual storage of, like Andrew was saying, of like words and semantics, like the actual meanings are widespread throughout the brain. And they call it the mental lexicon, is the idea, is that there's just kind of these associative trees all throughout our brain that are kind of mapping how connected different words are to each other in these different kind of semantic categories, right? And so if I say like a certain food, there's probably going to be a lot of foods that are associated with that, right? I say potatoes and you might think of like gravy or chicken or cheese and sour cream, right? All of those things seem to be kind of clustered together. And you can do that with like priming studies where so if I were to say bed, pillow, blanket, sleep, sheet, right? If I were to then ask you if the word dream was in that list, you'd be much more likely to say yes, even though it wasn't, than if I were to say some word like hey, right? Because I already had that whole network, that whole associative tree active and all of those things associated with it. And so you think that like it, there's a high probability that it was, right? And there's also priming studies where I tricked Andrew earlier today, right? if I'm talking to you about life on a farm, I'm feeding the cows, I'm feeding the chickens, right? And then I see hair, you probably think that hair that I saw, it probably refers to an animal. It refers to a rabbit, right? I'm not talking about someone's hair. That's this idea that I've now primed all of these associations. I've primed this tree of things that are connected to one another. And I've made it a lot more easy for you to access that word because that stuff is all online. Whereas if I were to then kind of switch categories, you would have to take time to then turn that other associative tree on that has all of those words associated with it.
All right. That is so interesting. It's, I was thinking as you were saying that, when you said hay, I was saying, well, if somebody's mattress is made of hay, then maybe they'll associate it there. But
right.
But yeah, and I think that is That is super fascinating. We've sort of talked a lot about speech right here, language processing in terms of auditory, you know, the sort of natural language that all of us naturally develop. But would you be open to talking a little bit more about reading and sort of reading and writing in that area?
I think there's one more thing I just want to end on real quick. And that's this point that I kind of brought up about Broca's area. So Broca's area seems to be about production of speech. But one of the things that they're finding that's really fascinating is that it seems to be really heavily involved in like working memory. So one of the things that you described with your friend was that it was these complicated maybe phrases or complicated ideas that were harder to comprehend. And so it's not, this area is not just about kind of speaking, but it's also about like holding a lot of stuff together, which makes sense with it being in the frontal lobe, that it's like piecing a lot of things together syntactically, right? So you have like all of these complicated parts coming together. I think that's one of like the biggest kind of areas of research right now, is really trying to understand what Broca's area actually does.
Yeah. And it also makes sense that it's in the frontal lobe, because other structures in the frontal lobe, as we've talked about a lot, are about movement, and especially about planning motor movements. And there are some studies that I read about that seem to show this dissociation between like Broca's area and then nearby regions that are involved in motor planning, where Broca's area seems to be specifically about planning, motor planning in terms of like what you're going to say, the little bit more abstract than just the specific, like, you know, tongue and lip movements that are required to make a specific sound. But that Broca's area may be feeding this more abstract plan of what to say and how to say it into those more general motor regions. And it makes sense, like given sort of the geography of the brain, that it's right in this frontal region that's about planning and about motor actions and executive functions. And, you know, in addition to that, just what you were just saying, like, I think most of us, when we're talking about reasoning, you know, many of us think best on paper, or think best when we're talking out loud to ourselves or talking to another person. And there's something to that where, you know, I don't want to go down this road of saying like, language is completely separate from reasoning and thought. Like, that would be kind of insane to say that, especially just, you know, given our experience. But that's, it's important to recognize, like, these networks interact with each other, and they probably, you know, can sort of enhance each other's functional capacity, things like that. So yeah, that's important to recognize as well.
So yeah, let's talk about reading, because this is fascinating. Like, my gosh, some of the reading stuff that we looked at just like blew my mind, because it's so new evolutionarily. Like we mentioned earlier, it's 5,000 years old at the latest. Like, actual reading with people, it was more like 3,500 years ago. And even then, like, most normal average people weren't reading. It was usually like people high up in government that were like using, or like in religion or whatever. And even like the Christian faith, like, it was only the priests that could read, and they were the ones that were like, this is what the Bible says, like, believe me.
Until Luther came around, right?
Right. But you have to think about how, like, the average person was not reading until very relatively recent in human history. Yet there seems to be like specific areas of the brain for reading, which doesn't make sense evolutionarily.
Yeah. And just to put into context the timescale that Taylor was just talking about, if you think about, so we'll just use really conservative estimates here just to make the point. So let's say that we're off of languages or written languages origin by a factor of two. So let's say it's 10,000 years old. Now, there's no evidence that it goes back any further than 5,000 years, but just for the sake of argument, let's say it's 10,000 years old. And the most conservative estimates on how long Homo sapiens, our species, has been around is like at minimum over 100,000 years. So if we're using those very conservative estimates, then written language has really only been around for a maximum, you know, in this crazy estimate, 10% of our species' entire time on this planet. So there's just not that much time for it to become you know, genetically coded to the extent that spoken language is. Now, again, the better estimates are 5,000 years and that our species has been around for more like 200 to 300,000 years. So it's like, you know, much smaller percentage of our entire history. But anyway, I think that's good because sometimes these years, they just sort of blend together.
No, and it's, I think the big point there too is that, again, this was something that it wasn't everyone either. Like this was a small percentage of people that were reading, yet somehow now there seems to be, so there's something called the visual word form area that seems to be really heavily implicated in our ability to read. It's left lateralized again. It's kind of back here in the temporal lobe, but it seems to be causal. If this area is damaged, you can no longer read, right? And that's just mind-blowing of like, okay, so we didn't have enough time evolutionarily really to develop a new region, yet somehow this region has kind of developed this ability uniquely to where if it's removed, you lose all ability to read. And I think too, something that you hinted at, Andrew, that's important to think about is that this hasn't had enough time genetically to get to the same point as kind of understanding language, being able to speak like what I talked about with my kid. And that makes sense when you think about how much work you have to put in to actually learn how to read.
Yeah, it is, and it's difficult. And one of those interesting phenomena that happened, oh, I wish I had, I was going to bring it here, but I recently found this drawing that I did when I was like 5 years old or 7 years old, and I signed my name on the back and, you know, said Andrew, but the E and the R were backwards, right? And that's a really common thing to observe in children, that they'll show this left-right sort of like mirror symmetry where they're not really differentiating between the left-right shape of the word. But like in my case, somehow I got the D right. It wasn't the other way around. So anyway, but the one interesting thing about that is this goes to some of the neuroscience of this area, this visual word form area, as it's been called. As Taylor mentioned, it's in this kind of like inferior temporal lobes, sort of near the back of the brain. And it's also really close by to regions that are involved in processing other very sophisticated visual stimuli, like a face or an object, and being able to differentiate between different faces. So it seems to have like sort of been co-opted by this region that is involved in this very fine grain differentiation between similar visual objects. And then we apply that to letters, right? And the reason I mentioned my inability to write the letter E and R in the right orientation when I was 7 years old is because some ideas around that are that humans have this like inherent sort of left-right mirror symmetry where we see something like if you see my face, right, and you see a mirror image of my face, you're not suddenly like, oh, who's that? I don't know who that is, right? You realize, okay, that's the same object. Or you see two hands, right, and they're mirror images of each other. That's the same object. So when you see an E and a backwards E, you know, the child's brain, as it's still trying to differentiate between these really similar symbols, just uses that same left-right mirror symmetry heuristic and is like, oh, well, it's an E, right? So it's just a straight line with three horizontal lines coming off of it.
I think that's really important to put into context too, because I think there's some theories right now that that could be what leads to dyslexia, that we actually have to train that out of our brain. Ancient Greeks actually wrote the first line left to right and then the second line right to left. The third line left to right, they did that, and they could read that fluently back and forth. And it was because that part of the brain, like Andrew was saying, is what's called view invariant. It's able to take in these mirror images of things and dissociate them from one another. But the more literate you become, the more practice that you have with these things, the more attention you put on these, it starts to change the way that region actually functions, to where it now only recognizes things left to right. And I'm not saying that like dyslexia is because they're not learning enough or whatever. It could just be that like that part of the brain is more resistant to changing that kind of that mirror kind of stuff that's going on, which is really cool. But yeah, the face stuff is interesting. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, it's I mean, it would make sense again in this like evolutionary context that you have this holdover from these other types of sort of visual perception, visual recognition of a face, right? You can tell the difference between my and Taylor's face instantly, right? And that seems to be unique to like social, especially social species, but we definitely have this area in the brain that is really important for that, that if it gets damaged, you can get like face blindness, where you don't really see much differentiation between individual faces. So it makes sense that this area that's involved in specifically recognizing letters and words would kind of grow out from that more general capacity to recognize differences between similar visual objects.
And this is in context with like the building process that we've talked about so much on this show, right? That like the early visual cortex, when you first see things, all those cells care about are whether or not there are lines at particular orientations and particular spots of space, right? And they'll fire for like this line like this, but not for this one, right? Or a horizontal line. And then those feed to another layer that then puts those lines together and says, okay, this is a continuous line because those are both horizontal. That feeds to another one that's like, oh, hey, there's a corner there, right? To eventually, once you've put all of these things together, you have certain kind of neurons that will fire for complex shapes. Instead of just for an individual line, they'll fire for like a hand, or the shape of a banana, right? Or in the case of facial perception, they'll fire for particular features of someone's face, right? That they've, as you've put all these features together, they've said, these are important for our survival, right? That I need to understand facial expression. I need to know when someone's angry or when someone's sad, that I can approach them in different ways, right? And so we have this really sophisticated object recognition pathway that's already kind of separating things out in distinguishable features. And the really cool thing about faces is that Nancy Kanwisher discovered the fusiform face area through her work and recognized that it seemed to be right lateralized, that it was just the right fusiform that was really, really sensitive to faces. But when you study illiterate people, people that never learned to read before in their lives, face recognition is bilateral. It's on both sides. Wow. And so what seems to happen is that the left side lost a lot of the ability to understand and distinguish facial features and left that to the right side. And it instead started to specialize in actual like configurations of lines. And this region also is right next to a region that cares a lot about line junctions too, about particular lines that are coming together, right? So like if I have two lines, I'm on video, if I have two lines that come together like a T, right? That's very different than two lines coming together in like a triangle, right? And if you have these line drawings, if you take those junctions out, it's hard to tell what it is. But you can insert kind of, you can break the lines in other places and you can still tell that it's like an airplane, even if there's like a bunch of pieces missing. But if you take out the parts where the lines come together, it's really hard to tell what it is. And so it seems to be that like we have this region that's really good at identifying like complex objects, like facial stuff, right next to these line junction area that ends up becoming the like letter, word form area.
Yeah, and it seems to be like this building process where those ones that are, those areas, those populations of neurons that are really recognizing lines are like you said, feeding into the areas that are recognizing line junctions. And then this is a building process getting us to more and more complex shapes. But yeah, I mean, it's, reading is such an interesting thing in general, because if you just, I mean, like, again, going back to what we were saying at the beginning, you're just hearing sounds, right? And then converting that into ideas in your head. Well, reading is maybe, I don't know if it's stranger, but it's just as odd that like you can look, if you're trained to read, you can look at a piece of paper and it's got all these squiggles and marks all over it. And then somehow your brain is differentiating between those very similar shapes and putting them together into words, into phrases, and into meaning. And you can, you know, have a strong emotional response to a poem, just a few lines of words. And it's, I mean, I think it's good to just reflect on how fascinating and weird this ability is.
And I mean, there's some really interesting stuff too, where like, it seems that the visual form of a word, right? You read some kind of a word on a page, has connected itself to the sound version of that word. So you have the visual one is now activating the sound one, which is also activating the meaning one. And there's actually evidence that because these things have become so like integrated with one another, that when you're reading, your brain actually looks like you're rehearsing those words, like you're saying those words in the regions that are involved in like production, even if you're like reading it silently in your head. And so it seems that like if we've mapped these onto sounds that are then kind of playing in our head in some way, even if it's unconscious, that kind of activate and release the meaning that's associated with them.
Totally. It makes sense that it would have to tap into this network. This is much more, robust or like evolutionarily more ancient. We've got this language network that's specialized really for speech and for processing auditory information or linguistic information rather. And so it's tapping into that. And it just, it accords with your experience as well. When you're reading a paper or a book or something, if you stop and think about the experience of that, it is really like you're talking to yourself inside your head. There are some forms of like speed reading where I think they try to get you to stop doing that. And those are a little, I don't really know much research around that, but my impression is that they're a little bit gimmicky and you lose a lot of the meaning that you would from just, slowing down and reading at your normal pace. But so it seems like at least for most people, kind of on a natural level, we tend to sort of talk to ourselves. We're reading it to ourselves in our head, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, and I think something that's interesting about like the speed reading and things like that is that I think they take advantage of something that the brain is really good at, and that's gist. That when I'm talking to you, when I'm reading something, I'm not remembering every single word, every single sentence. Like I challenge any of you to repeat back any of the sentences that we've said, right? You can't do it because your brain is extracting the gist of what we're saying. And it's attaching it to kind of meaning that you already had. And so the gist that Andrew gets is probably going to be different than the gist that I get or the gist that someone else gets. If we have very similar experiences, if we have very similar kind of ideas around these things, we might be getting the same thing out of them. And there's actually really interesting evidence that shows that might be the case. But it's really interesting looking at how this is kind of coming to the next level. And so I think something that we can maybe touch on as we're kind of rounding this out is that a lot of the newer work, especially in the field, like I have natural language processing studies that I do that heavily involve the default mode network, something that we haven't really touched on at all throughout the episode. And that's, it seems to be at the top of this hierarchy, that we have the individual sounds that are coming in that are being put into words. Those words are being put into sentences. We have parts of our brain that are making sure the grammatical structure is correct and that the sentence actually makes sense. That sentence is then embedded within a larger context of like, who is the person in the sentence? What are they doing? What were they doing before? What are they probably going to do next, right? As we build this whole narrative. And what we see is that as the narrative gets longer and longer, you start to get higher up the cortical hierarchy, where you have regions of the brain that are able to keep track of longer and longer terms of information. And then even access through, so the default mode has a lot of access to the hippocampus, and so it can actually bring up memories. And so as you're reading things, as you're doing these things, the default mode is activating through the hippocampus a bunch of stuff that's related so that it can combine it with all of this stuff. And something that I've seen developmentally, like with my son, is the default mode is something that that develops later in life, right? And so you have, as you're growing, an ability to understand longer and longer narratives as you get older, to understand longer periods of time and how things are connected, to connect things to past experiences and all of these things. And so it's this really interesting phenomenon that like now this is the next step of we're taking the literal meaning of all of these words and the meaning of this sentence, but now we're embedding it in our entire kind of social context and who we are and what we're doing and how it's important to us and all of these things. And that's the stuff that's really interesting to me. That's like what I study.
Yeah, and Taylor's you're hinting at the interaction of all these networks, that the language network necessarily interacts with the default mode network, and there's, just to kind of tack on to what you were just saying, there's these really interesting studies I read a few years ago, and actually made some videos about them, but they're called by a guy named Keith Oatley, who is both a neuroscientist and a novelist. And he wrote these studies about fiction and the brain. And what kind of his hypothesis, his theory about what is going on is that we are, when we're reading novels like or fiction, when we're consuming, especially like high quality literary fiction, we are, our brains are using that as kind of a simulation of what could be, of like a possible world. And so, you know, you're getting into this character's mind and you're understanding their desires and their beliefs and intentions and their social interactions. And you're using that as almost like a simulation and a scaffold for understanding the social world better. And it is very much like what Taylor was talking about, where you have to, the default mode network is so important for incorporating and understanding ourselves and the larger narrative of what's being said. And it can be seen as this simulation engine in some ways, where, especially when you're talking about the hippocampus is so important for memory retrieval, but it's also important for like spatial reasoning, but also planning for the future, for especially episodic future thought, thinking about a specific situation that could happen. So anyway, just that's a super interesting.
And you have the area. Temporal parietal junction in the default mode. That's all about theory of mind, about understanding others' intentions, understanding who they are, what they're going to do, right? And I think that that's why fiction is so inherently enjoyable, is because it allows us to create this like realistic thing that we could embed ourselves in, that our brain loves trying to understand social structure, right? That we have this whole system that just evolved to understand the structure of language. But we have these other systems that are really, really interested in understanding the structure of our social environment. One of the things that really stood out, I mentioned Alexander Huth earlier, and how he did this study where he looked at like how we have different words are kind of mapped to these different areas of our brain. So we have this one part of the brain where you have a lot of like numericity stuff will come up. Like, so if you say numbers, if you talk about multiplication, like that's where those words are coming up. A lot of the stuff in the default mode network, the words are very social. And he had this one region that it seemed to be really highly active for pleasantry, for saying things like please and thank you. And like that, it's just like, for some reason, every time someone in the narrative said something that was polite, it was like, hey, and so we see this like this structure building of like trying to understand the social world and the culture that we're embedded in and how people dynamically interact with one another, that that our brain just loves to try to figure out, I think. And I think that's why some of these things are so enjoyable. But language is cool.
Yeah. If you walk away with anything from this episode, it should be that you should be polite, because it'll cause a stronger brain response from your conversation partner. No. Yeah. And it is, I think all this is just interesting to, again, go back to the evolutionary history and how stories are so important for our species, how we understand the world, how we go about planning our lives. It's all kind of can be seen in this story-based way. And language is definitely enhancing and sort of tapping into that in multiple different ways.
And I think that I honestly think it's the greatest invention a brain anywhere has ever created, because it allows for a completely different way to associate things with one another, right? Before, when we had to remember something, we had to say like that specific thing right there is connected to that specific thing right over there. But now if I can abstract those two things, if I can turn them into symbols, I can combine these in any way that I want in a simulated way. Right now, all of these symbols are in my head and I can be creative with them. I can combine them in new, novel ways. Right. And so it really shows, I think, that language was, I think, the birth of a lot of the creative innovativeness that the human species has been successful with. The division of labor, right, that I talked about earlier, that it really allowed us to encapsulate big ideas, big tasks, big goals into communicatable kind of sentences, symbols, right? So This has been a really fun one. Again, I said I used to just like hate language, and now I have like come full circle. I think this is one of the coolest things that the brain is able to accomplish. And it's just, I think the one big takeaway that I want most people to come away with is that we take so much of this for granted. Like, we just said probably how many thousand words over this last hour. And you were able to just seamlessly put these things together. I hope so. into a kind of understanding, a narrative of how these processes are unfolding in the brain. And don't take that for granted. Think about how amazing that is and try to understand how you can leverage that to maybe help with your life and remembering and understanding things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also fascinating. If I had one takeaway other than politeness for people to walk away with is, is just, mine's maybe a little bit more technical, but conceiving of the brain's language system as this intermediate between sort of low level perception and kind of high level cognition and reasoning. And that it is a maybe not a module, but it is a network in the brain that is responsible for this kind of processing, and it's specific to language. And that is really a fascinating thing about the human brain that may be present to some lower, more intermediate or more, you know, low level extent in other species, but it is very much advanced and taken to a whole nother level in Homo sapiens. So like Taylor said, don't take it for granted. Think about it as a tool and something that's very cool about you, human, and I'm talking to.
If you've made it this far, we are going to kind of preview our next episode is going to be about creating an artificial brain. How do we do that? What are the kind of connections between neuroscience and the rise of artificial intelligence? And something that Andrew just hinted at is that language seems to be this intermediate between sensory processing and high-level reasoning. And it seems that AI has gotten really good at sensory processing and language, but not really good at the kind of high level reasoning. And so we're kind of going to kind of look at what it's going to take to maybe get there. We're going to take a little bit of a break because congratulations to this guy. He is getting married this weekend. My wife is probably going to have another child in the next couple of weeks. So it is going to be a busy month, but we're going to do a lot of research on this one and try to get it out here in the next month. And we just thank all of you for continuing to listen and hang on.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we will be back. We'll have a short break. But in the meantime, if you want to get more content from us, you can go check out our Patreon. You've probably seen some of the preview episodes of our Social Brain Patreon only episodes. But if you want to get access to the full version of those, go to patreon.com/thesocialbrain and you can sign up and you'll immediately get access to those. So we appreciate everybody's support, just watching this, just being a member of our audience for so long. It's really an awesome thing that we can do. So thank you.
Awesome. We'll see you guys for the next one.